All right, I call your attention tonight to James chapter 3. We have finally made it to the third chapter. We're not quite halfway through. We might get halfway through the book tonight. Maybe. Okay. But if not, we'll do it like we've had to do on a couple of occasions. We'll just take the sausage, we'll cut it off right there, and we'll pick it up next week. Okay. The first two chapters that we have covered, if we were going to, I guess, give each title a chapter, it would be something like this. Chapter one would be patience during our testings or our trials. If you would look at chapter two, you would find that it would be like practicing the truth. In other words, if you have faith, then you show it by the way that you conduct your life, the way that you work. You prove your fruit, so to speak. And so when you look at the whole book, those would be, I guess, the first two chapter titles. And of course, you realize that the chapter divisions were put there by man. They were not put there by James, the preacher at the church at Jerusalem and the Lord's half-brother. But this was just so that you and I can find certain portions of the epistle quickly. And so chapter 1 has to do with patience during our testing and our trials. Chapter 2 has to do with the way that we prove our faith, just as Abraham and just as Rahab did. Now let me get you to do something for me tonight. I want you to know that what we're going to talk about tonight, I mean, it is in every one of your mouths right now. I want you to stick your tongue out. Stick it out. Come on. All right. Some of you are going, I'm not doing that. Okay. Did you know that may be the greatest manifestation of tongues I've ever been around? You know, there are churches that have split over the gift of tongues. And of course, it's a very simple thing for me. If you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, it says, whether there be tongues, they shall cease. I mean, that's pretty simple. I heard one preacher say one time, I don't speak in tongues, Jesus never did. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good example to follow right there. But there are churches that have had a problem with that particular doctrine. Of course, we've never had that problem here because we're Baptists. We're people of the book. And so we have had a problem, though, not with the gift of tongues, but with tongues. I mean, there's a lot of folks like to wag them. A lot of wag them, all right? A lot of wagging going on. Well, I heard about one lady and I guess I'll just go ahead and tell you the church. It was Moody Church up in Chicago. I wasn't going to name the name of the church, but I don't know any of the pastors there now, so I'll just tell you. A few years back, there was a lady that was bad to gossip. And she kind of got herself in a tight. And so whenever, you know, she got caught, then she immediately wanted to kind of, you know, repent. The only problem was she had done it several times before. And so because she had done it several times before, the preacher wasn't really believing, or the pastor she was talking to wasn't really believing that she was sincere. It was just that she wanted to repent because she got caught. You know, it's kind of like a kid saying, I'm sorry, when they got caught with their hand in the cookie jar. And so she said, oh, pastor, I need God to forgive me. And he said, well, ma'am, what's wrong? Well, he already knew what was wrong. And she said, I've said some things that I ought not have said. And I need to lay my tongue on the altar. And he looked at her and he said, I'm sorry, we don't have an altar that big. You know, that's pretty hard for a preacher to say. But after you've gone through it three or four times with the same person, after a while it's like, well, maybe they're not as sincere and maybe they needed a little shock therapy. And so he told her, said, we don't have an altar that big at our church. Well, if you look at our chapter tonight, we're going to try to cover the first 12 verses. And as we look at these verses, and we're going to read through them here in just a moment, there are six pictures or six metaphors that are used in these 12 verses. And we're going to go through those one at a time, and we're going to kind of talk about each one of them. And we'll have 3 points. Each point will have two of the pictures that will substantiate the point. But what I want us to do tonight is I want to have you help me out. I want to ask you to read some verses. I want to get a few of you to help me out with this. All righty, let me call some people here. Brian, right over here, let me get you to read Proverbs 18:21. Trent, let me get you to read Proverbs 16:23. Chris, sitting in the back, let me get you to read Psalm 141:3. And Brother Bill Childers, let me get you to read Matthew 12:34. Okay? All right. Let's have Brian read Proverbs 18:21 and try to read and speak as loud as you can. Need my glasses? Okay, did you hear that? Death and life are in the power of the tongue. That's in Proverbs. By the way, when you read through Proverbs, it's got a lot to say about speech. Okay? As a matter of fact, one of the messages that I preached about 3 years ago, I preached out of Proverbs chapter 6 about six things doth God hate, yea, seven are an abomination to him. And I preached on that seventh one. All right? Proverbs 16:23. Okay, did you hear that? The heart of the wise addeth learning to his lips. So in other words, if your heart's right, your lips are going to be right in what you say. All right? Chris, Psalm 141, verse 3. So set a watch, set a guard over my mouth. There's times whenever we want to say something so bad, we ought to take both of our hands and go, don't let me say it. All right? Brother Bill, Matthew 12:34. Okay, what is Jesus talking? He's talking to these Pharisees, and he said, you generation of vipers, out of your heart are these evil things coming. All right? And so, you have various passages of Scripture. You got some in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament, the ones that we have here tonight. And now tonight, he is just really going to hammer this. He's already touched on it. If you doubt that, look back at chapter 1, verse 19. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. All right? Look down at verse 26 of chapter 1. If anybody seems to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, he deceiveth his own heart. And so, now, as he's touched on those things in the epistle, as Matthew touches on it in the words of Jesus, and as the Old Testament touches on it, so tonight, James is going to just nail this point hard tonight. All right? Now, let me ask you a question. If everything that you said was recorded, or it was written down in a book, how would that govern what you say? 40 years ago, I heard this, that there was a theory that some scientists had espoused, and I heard Cecil Hodges say this, and And I've never been able to substantiate it, but I've never been able to forget it either. Supposedly every word that is ever spoken by anybody, because of the speed of sound and as it leaves, that it is always out there somewhere. Just because it's out of hearing distance does not mean that it's no longer in existence. So that means that if that hypothesis is true, everything that you have ever spoken, everything that I have ever spoken, is still bannering around somewhere in the universe or the ethernet, all right? It's still out there. Suppose there is something that God has, and it is collecting every idle word. Every word that you and I speak, even flippant words. And then one day when we stand at the judgment seat of God, all of that is played back. All of that is rehearsed. Is that not scary? When there's somebody and you just got something in your craw against that person, and you just don't like them, and so you're going to just take them down a notch. We better be careful about that, because God may be having that recorded. Because you know what? Out of the heart, the mouth speaks. Somebody goes, well, I know that I cussed, but I didn't really mean to. And I'm thinking, well, it had to be in there somewhere. I mean, it had to be there somewhere. I had something happen one time, and I said, son of a biscuit eater. And Sandy Dietz, who was a secretary at the time, she grabbed herself and she goes, oh, oh, oh. She said, when you said those first two words, before I thought about it, I thought you were going to cuss. And I said, well, I wanted to, but I didn't say it, so I substituted. So maybe the Lord's still going to hold me guilty because of my thought about it, but I didn't say it. And so, what if every word that you said was recorded? Let's be very careful in what comes from this little member that you just stuck at me just a moment ago. Now, listening to the right voice is important. It's very important. If you listen to the wrong voice, it can mean death. I read the story of a lady back around 1930. She and her little child, her little boy, was traveling on a train, and it was in dead of winter up north. And she was as nervous as she can be because she had an appointment and she had to get off at just the right town. And as she was going out through the Midwest in the dead of winter, and they would have these various stops, when the conductor would come by, when she thought it was getting close to her stop, she would say, are we at my stop yet? And he would say, no, ma'am, I told you, when we get to your stop, I will let you know. Well, a man that was sitting next to her had heard this conversation a couple of times, and he looked at her and he said, ma'am, look. He said, I travel this route all the time. And he said, I know where all the stops are. You know, I mean, after all, I mean, I've been on this train a couple of times already this year. You know, the conductors, sometimes they get busy. You know, and he might forget, but I'll tell you where to get off. And she said, well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And the conductor come by again, and he goes, I got you. I'm not going to forget you. Well, all of a sudden, the train begins to stop. And it stops. And she's thinking, I wonder if this is it. And the man next to her said, hey, this is your stop. It's where you're to get off. So very quickly, she grabs her bag, she grabs her little boy, out the door they go, and the train takes off. The conductor, a few minutes later, he comes by and he goes, "Where's the lady?" "Oh, she got off at her stop." He said, "That wasn't her stop." He said, "We were stopping to take on water at the water tower." They quickly stopped the train. By the time they got a group of people that had gotten bundled up enough to go out into to the blizzard to find the lady and walk back up the tracks, it was probably an hour, hour and a half before they could get there. And they found the woman and the little boy frozen to death because she listened to the wrong man. You listen to the wrong people, and it can mean death. That's why I'm very careful about who I listen to on television. You got guys with big smiles and sets of teeth. You got guys, and I mean, they've got the charisma. And their people flock to them by the tens of thousands. But they know nothing about biblical salvation. You've got people, and the only thing that they're doing is they're saying, "I'm going to tell these people what they want so they can send me some cash." And you have them deceiving people by the thousands. And the devil's going, "Listen to him, listen to him, listen to him." I mean, can 100,000 people be right? Yes, they can be right. Listen to them. And I'm going, "No, no, no. 100,000 people can be wrong." When you look at things in the Bible, there's a lot of times when the crowd has got it wrong. When those 12 tribes went over into the promised land and they came back and they were given their report, wasn't it the majority that said, "The giants are over there and it's just too tough, let's don't do it"? And because of their report, it was 10-2. The people said, "We're not going over there." And Joshua and Caleb said, "Let's go. God will be with us." But 10 of them prevailed on the people, and they would not go. And because of that, they wandered for 4 decades in the desert. The majority is not always right. And so you and I need to realize that listening to the right people are important. Now I want you to look with me at verse number 1. My brethren, again, we're talking about saved people. Be not many masters. And the word masters there means teachers. Now what was taking place? Most people think that in the early church, a lot of times doctrine had not been formally set yet. The apostles had not been able to teach and teach and teach. And so when people got saved, you had people that maybe would look and go, "Hey, those guys that are in charge, that looks pretty cool." And so they were saying, "I want to do that." And there's some people that would say, well, one day they would have this person teach, and the next time they'd have that person teach, and the next thing you know, you got 50 or 75 different people, and they're all clamoring with different things. But there's no basic set of doctrine that has been put together. You've got people that are scattered from Dan to Beersheba. You got people that are scattered in other countries. And so what are they doing? They're just sitting around saying, "Well, I think this." It wasn't until people like the Apostle Paul came along and began to give those epistles as word from God that there began to be a solidification of biblical doctrine. And so James is trying to thwart that with all of these people that he's writing to, and he said, "Brethren, be not many masters." Now, why is that? Knowing that we shall receive, notice the "we" there. He's putting himself in that category. We who are teachers shall receive the greater condemnation or the greater judgment. Do you know that if you are a preacher or a teacher, and I'm going to even throw Sunday school teachers into this mix, if you are a preacher or a teacher, God is going to hold you to a higher standard than the average layperson. Because you have assumed that leadership position. Now, God may have gifted you for that, and I certainly believe that God calls people to preach. You don't get to just go, well, hey, I think I'll be a preacher one day. There's qualifications that have to be met, according to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1. And so you have qualifications, but I'm going to tell you, if you are not sure about that calling, you better be careful about it. Because the judgment that you are going to face is going to be a higher bar than what the average person faces. That means that your integrity is going to be more scrutinized. That means that your speech is going to be more scrutinized. That means that your behavior is going to be more scrutinized. The way that you conduct your daily affairs is going to be scrutinized at the judgment seat more than just the average person. Why? Because you're a leader. And if you are taking on the mantle of teaching the Word of God, you've got a greater judgment that's coming to you. Well, the first thing that I want you to see is this. I want you to see that direction can be found with the tongue. Look at verse 2. For in many things we offend all. Now, what is the word all there? That means without exception. Every one of us offend at some point. Well, I can tell you one thing this does. This wipes out the people that believe in sinless perfection. Somebody said that, I haven't sinned because I've been so perfect now in my relationship with God, I haven't sinned in 20 years. And there are people that literally will preach that they have not done that. I don't know if it's folklore or not. I've not read it anywhere personally about Spurgeon, but supposedly the story goes that a man told Spurgeon that one time. He said, I have reached the state of sinlessness where I no longer sin. And said the man turned to speak to somebody else, and Mr. Spurgeon took a cold glass of water and dumped it on his back. And said the man wheeled and started cursing a blue streak. And Mr. Spurgeon said, I thought you were sinless. To prove the point that he wasn't. Every one of us are going to have snafus, so to speak. But we ought to want to be sinless. But this verse right here, for in many things we offend all. In other words, we fall short of the mark. We give offense in certain things. And in verse 2 it says, if any man offend, if he offends not in word. In other words, if the way that you speak to people, you don't offend, if you don't offend people, you don't cause them to have grief toward you, if you can do that, the same is a perfect man. Now, the word perfect does not mean without blemish. It has the idea of somebody that is mature or somebody that is complete. And he said, and he's also able, if you're a complete man, if you're a perfect man or a mature man, you're able also to bridle the whole body. In other words, if you can discipline that, the rest of it is easier. Now, it's not easy, but it's easier. There are very, very few people that I have ever met that have been able to bridle things that are negative out of their mouth. We've got a guy in this church that I have never one time heard anything derogatory, negative, or something that was ripping on somebody else. in close to 25, maybe even close to 30 years. He has never one time in my presence done this. Now he may tell his wife. He may tell somebody else. But in all the years that I have known Travis Lindsay, not one time have I ever heard Travis say anything negative. And it was might have been common knowledge. And he would simply say, "Yeah, you know, we just got to pray for him. You know, just got to pray. You know, and, well, you know, Trav, how's so and so doing? Well, you know, they just need us to pray for him." He didn't go, "Well, let me tell you what I heard." Never have I ever heard him say that. He's an exception. I mean, he is an exception. Now, perhaps you've got somebody in your life that you can point that to. But in verse 2, if a man doesn't offend in word, that guy's mature. And so, direction can be found with the tongue. He said, "Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths, that they may obey us. And we turn about their whole body." Now you think about that for a moment. You got a 12 to 1500 pound animal. That animal, if you tried to wrestle that thing, you're going to lose every time. Brother Don told me one time, he said, a horse will wait 20 years to kill you. I mean, they'll be just as calm as they can be, and all of a sudden one day, if you're not, you walk behind them, they'll kick you in the head. It may spook them, whatever. You've got that 1,200-pound animal, but you can take a bit with a bridle and you can put it in his mouth, and you can make that horse do whatever you want him to do. Many years ago, we had just moved into this location, to this facility, and we had a college and career activity down at the preacher's farm. And so they wanted me to go down there, and so I went down, and he had a big old horse that belonged to Jeff. And that was a mean horse. And so they were like, "Well, what horse are you going to ride, Brother Tommy?" Well, I mean, he was the biggest one, and I was probably the biggest one there, so I said, "Well, I'll ride the big one." So I got up on that horse, and he looked around at me like, "What has just got on my back?" Well, as we got out, kind of walking through the pasture, this horse decided he was going to start running. And I thought, he ain't doing that to me. And I pulled back on those reins as hard as I could, and his head turned around, and he was trying to go. He was wanting to get back to the barn. And I thought, you may throw me off this thing, but your head's coming with me. And finally, I held so much pressure on him that he finally quit. And I was able to walk slowly back, and I finally got off of that rascal. But if I wouldn't have had that bridle on that horse, I'd have been in heap big trouble. He'd have hurt me bad. He might have thrown me off in a tree on a fence. Might have threw me off, stepped on me. But as long as I had that bit in his mouth, I had a semblance of control. That's the picture. That's the first metaphor that's given. You put a bit in a horse's mouth, and they obey, and we turn about their whole 1,200-pound body with that bit. We turn them right, we turn them left. Why? Because it's pulling on their mouth. And so the tongue, it needs to be controlled just like a bit in a horse's mouth. But there's also direction that is seen with ships. Look at verse 4. Behold, also the ships, which though they be so great, in other words, it doesn't matter how big the ship is. I mean, it can be a little small boat that's got one little sail on it, or it could be a big boat that's got multiple sails on it. They are driven of fierce winds, yet they are turned about with a very small helm. The word helm there means rudder. So what you've got is you've got a big old boat and you've got a little bitty rudder that's sticking off the back end of that boat, and that thing just turns. You go, no, I've seen those pirate ships and they got the captain up there and he's got the wheel. Yeah? And that wheel is connected to some ropes that go back to the rudder. You take a boat that has an inboard motor on it, and you're driving up there with the steering wheel, you know what it is? There's cables on the back there. And they're pulling that boat this way, that way. You know why? Because that little movement on the back end of that boat where that rudder would be, it gives it direction. And so the two metaphors that we have as far as direction, it has to do with a bit in a horse's mouth and a rudder on a ship. The second thing that we see about the tongue, and this will probably be all we'll have time for tonight, is found in verse 5 through 9. We can see that destruction can be caused by the tongue. Destruction. Even so, the tongue is a little member. Very few things that you've got on your body that are as small as a tongue. Your hand is bigger than a tongue. Your feet's bigger than a tongue. You know, your tongue's probably smaller than many ears. You could probably count, you know, toes or fingers and maybe get something that's comparable. But it's a little member. I mean, it's not nearly as big as a thigh or a calf or a bicep. But what does it do? It boasteth great things. I'm going to tell you something. The tongue can write a check that your body might not can cash. That tongue can get you in trouble. It can start running its mouth, and all of a sudden you think you're Superman. The only problem is there's a bunch of kryptonite around. But that old tongue goes, yeah, I can handle it. I got backup. Well, you might not have that much backup. And so it boasteth great things. It can talk about how wonderful you are. And it can talk about how bad somebody else is. And it can start all kind of trouble. But then you notice what it says. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. It's a fire. That's the third metaphor. Third picture. Now you think about a fire and how sometimes a fire can get away from you. And you say one or two little things, and the next thing you know, that thing is took off, and it is just trouble in every one of your relationships. You may not even have meant it to be the wrong way, but yet it's caused an issue. You could have said something in innocence, but even the tone in which you said it can be misunderstood. And so the fire, oh, it is just, it can blaze. What does it say? It's a world of iniquity. It's a world of sin. What does it do? Well, it defileth the whole body. What does defile mean? It means to make dirty. I haven't thought about this until this week, but I heard a preacher say that the tongue can break every one of the Ten Commandments. And I thought, you know, I've been around a little bit. I don't know if I've ever heard that. But I began to kind of think about it the last couple of days, and I thought, you know, I guess that's probably true. You could take every one of the Ten Commandments, and somehow the tongue can break that commandment. I mean, especially if you get to thinking about what Jesus said, things about adultery. I mean, if you just think it in your heart, well, what comes out in the mouth? What's in the heart? I mean, you can steal with your tongue. You can steal a person's character, their reputation, and the way that people think about them. I think the guy's name was Donovan, I believe. And many years ago during Watergate, back when President Nixon basically was forced to resign, they were interviewing and basically excoriating anybody that was in the Nixon administration. And this Donovan man, at the end of the hearings, they said, okay, you're exonerated. You haven't done anything. And he looked at the committee of congressmen there and he said, well, what office do I go to now? And they said, well, you don't have to go to an office. You're done. You're free to go. He said, no, I want to know what office I go to get my name back. You see, you got these congressmen up there, and they were ripping this guy a new one. They were guilt by association. And then all of a sudden, they got what they wanted. And then they go, oh, get out of here. You're free to go. Well, his character had already been ripped on. I mean, they had already begun to besmirch his name. And so, destruction can be found by the tongue. It says, it sets on fire the course of nature. In other words, it can devastate when it comes to just things in the natural world, a fire can. But that is the picture that he's wanting us to see. You think about what's going on. Right now, I mentioned Travis just a moment ago. He flew out Tuesday to go handle the fires in California. Somebody said, several hundred people have died already because of those fires. There was an elderly couple that died out there. One was 94, one was 95, because they didn't want to get out of their home, and they died because of that. It says that it's a world of iniquity. It's set on fire of hell. And that word hell there is an interesting word. It's the word Gehenna. It's not there anymore. Now they have tried to straighten it up a little bit, and they've got some apartments that are close around to it. But outside the city of Old Jerusalem, there was an area that was a valley. And it was also called the Valley of Hinnom. The Greek word is Gehenna. And that's where the people of Jerusalem would take their refuge. That's where they would drag old animals. And many times the authorities, if it was a person that was a vagabond, nobody knew them or anything, they would drag them out there and their bodies would just rot. And there would be a fire that would be constantly burning. And when you read about Jesus, when he says that hell is like that, where that the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched, they were looking at Gehenna, that valley of Hinnom. That's the word that James uses here in verse 6. He said, it's set on fire of Gehenna. And in verse 7 it says, and every kind of beast and birds and serpents of the and the things of the sea is tamed and has been tamed of mankind. But the tongue, no. It's an unruly evil. And here's our fourth metaphor. It's full of deadly poison. Deadly poison. Now, I don't know what the most deadly poisonous animal is in the world. Somebody said that, and I think I was telling Bob and Charlotte this the other day, they've got a granddaughter that's going to Australia. And I said, just as a way of encouragement, I just want you to know that in Australia, 7 of the world's 10 most deadliest animals and insects are in Australia. I just wanted to encourage you with that. They got a granddaughter and her husband going there. I don't know what the most deadly poison in the world is. I was told that if you took a bottle of potassium cyanide, if you opened the bottle, touched the cap to your tongue, that you would be dead before you could put the cap back on. That's deadly. The tongue is a deadly poison. It can kill people's reputations. It can kill people's spirits. It can break up families. It can cause all kinds of problems. Warren Wiersbe told the story. He said he was in, and I'll finish this message next week. He told the story how that he was in London, England. And one of the things, when you're a preacher, you just like things like this. You like going to old bookstores. You like looking at books. Somebody said, I'm a preacher, but I don't like to read. I doubt your calling. Because the call to preach is the call to prepare. That's why it's important to go to Bible school, Bible college. I mean, you need to know what you're talking about. Why? Because you're going to have a greater judgment, as we talked about earlier. But Wiersbe was at a place called Charing Cross Road over in London. And he was thinking that old London, all of these ancient Puritan writers, a lot of these old guys from the 16th, 17th, 1800s, they may have things that I could get in these rare bookstores. I know when Preacher went over to England, he was able to get some books by people like George B. Duncan, those types of guys. And Wiersbe's there, and he remarks to a man in a bookstore there on Charing Cross Road. He said, you know, I'm amazed that there's not more of these old books and more of these old bookstores like yours around. You're kind of a rarity in yourself. And the man looked at him, and he said, well, it wasn't always that way. He said, but it's been that way now for over 40 years, this story happened several years ago. He said, what happened was during World War II, when the Germans began to bomb London with their air force, I think it's called a Luftwaffe. When they began to bomb London, they would drop bombs that were called incendiary bombs. And when they would hit, not only would they explode, but they would cause fires. And they said, as they were bombing London, those bombs would hit and would begin to spread fires. And he said, the stores that sold books would burn quickly because of the paper. And he said, during those fires that we lost well over 1 million books that were rare and antique. And so that's why there's only just a few stores that are left. All the books are gone. Because fire demolished them, burned them to ashes. Just nothing but just ashes left. In the, I guess it was probably the mid to late 1800s, in Chicago, there was a great fire. And in this great fire, in just the matter of a day or two because of this fire. And of course, they didn't have fire departments as we have now, but they were just doing the best they could. Most of the buildings were wooden. But there was the Great Fire of Chicago, And in about a day and a half to 2 days, 100,000 people were homeless because they had no homes to go to. 17,000 buildings and houses burned. 300 people died. And it all started because of one cow. Miss O'Leary's milk cow kicked a lantern over in their barn.